routes out across 16630. They would not have been aware that they were crossing a border. See, it is nothing more than an imaginary line. Ty couldn't help laughing.
Einstein, if we ever get out of this, I'm going to send you to charm school.
Huh?
Etiquette classes for Ivans. How to talk to people of other races.
Why?
Never mind. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Those scouts must then have seen some red border troops, Neoanders.
And if you were in their moccasins, what would you think when you first laid eyes on a Neoander?
Bug-eyed, no. Monster, yes.
Ty nodded. With due respect for Bard and his kin, it would have been better if the first spacers they encountered had been Dynans.
What of the Neoanders? Einstein asked. It took Ty a moment to follow.
If they saw the diggers while the diggers were seeing them, they'd have reported it.
Red knew about the diggers, maybe a long time ago.
Knew, or at least suspected, Ty agreed.
He could feel parts of his brain relaxing as the mystery dissolved.
They put their intelligence assets to work on it. Ariane started sniffing around for clues, used her connections to survey for all they were worth, pulled strings to get assigned to the Seven, and brought home the prize.
If you want to think of Marge as a prize, Einstein responded. Searching the boy's face in firelight, Ty couldn't tell whether this was deadpan humor or just more social cluelessness. It didn't matter, though.
The pingers!
Einstein called out, as if it were obviously the next topic.
Sonar tax law said they were sea people, before Donno shut her up, Ty said.
Do you think he beats her?
Einstein asked. It was such an emotional can of worms that Ty considered it carefully before asking. Once in his life, before the war, he had fallen for a girl as quickly as Einstein had for sonar tax law. That one brief experience with stupid blind love sufficed to make it possible for him to acknowledge its reality and respect its power.
I think, he said, that their society is comfortable with corporal punishment to the point where what keeps people like her in line is the fear of it, not the reality. I think there's nothing you can do about it, and that if you do so much as look sideways at Donno, he will kill you. But you can probably get away with small gestures of kindness toward the psych, assuming you're ever allowed near her again. If you show her too much favor, she will be punished. If you touch her, we're all dead.
Why?
Because this is one of those cultures that is psychotic about female reproductive organs. Now, let's get back to the pingers. Name mean anything to you?
No. You? Said Einstein. Ty's peroration had affected him terribly and reduced him to monosyllables.
I have a vague recollection, Ty said, but I will have to look it up to be sure.
Sea people suggest boats, Einstein said,
but we'd have noticed those.
Maybe it's a contingent of diggers that hides in the thick forests along the coast, Einstein tried.
Donno claimed all the land, though, Ty said, and said the pingers had jurisdiction over the oceans.
So what's your theory?
I don't have one, Ty said.
He was lying. This ended the evening's conversation. They rolled out sleeping bags and bedded down. Ty slept surprisingly well. He woke up once to the howling of wild canids. The volcanic eruptions that had been making the ash wall so thick seemed to have abated, for the stars had come out, and the habitat ring was now visible in the southern sky, the eye shining somewhere above the Galapagos. The canids had spied it too, apparently. He crawled out of his bag to take a leak, then checked on Kath too. She was shivering, her forehead hot, but not to a point that he considered alarming. They had taken his timepiece away from him, but he guessed it was about 3 in the morning, 12 hours, perhaps, since the Thor had touched down. Ariane and Marge would be reaching a red habitat around now. For, according to the inexorable laws of orbital mechanics, transfer time to geosync was always about 12 hours. He wondered if they were going to the red capital of Kyoto, or to some military habitat, or even to the Kulak, hovering above the Makassar Strait. The booth would be crowded with the two of them in it. He could only speculate on what Marge's state of mind must have been. The confrontation over the Srap Tasmaner most people would have considered strange and violent. The stuff of bizarre post-traumatic nightmares. She couldn't have seen her gunpoint abduction by Ariane coming. But all that was perfectly normal compared to what had happened next. It was unlikely Marge had looked into the sky and seen the Thor approaching. All she would have known was that suddenly she was trapped in a small booth with an armed mutant and experiencing powerful G-forces for the first time in her life. A few minutes later, she'd have known weightlessness. Probably not how Marge had seen her day shaping up when she had rolled out of the sack this morning. Had Ariane begun to interrogate her straight away? Or played nice with her? Or perhaps just jabbed her with a dose of tranquilizer to tide her over for 12 hours? To Marge, the Thor just would have been unutterably bizarre. To Ty or any other spacer, it was clearly an act of war, the most egregious violation of treaty that he had heard of in 20 years. Though, come to think of it, he'd picked up enigmatic snatches of conversation, exchanged between persons of import in the crow's nest, hinting at dark doings in the South Seas. Presumably there was a reason that they, whoever they were, had chosen Belid Tomov as the Teklin member of the Seven. Belid, whose back was cratered with scars that could only have resulted from pitched battle with whip-cracking Neoanders. Likewise, there was apparently more to Bard than met the eye. And Ty? He too was a veteran of ground combat, with the scars to prove it. But there were many others who might have been chosen in his stead, ones better suited to leading an expedition and making first contact with what to the spacers was an alien race from another planet. No, Ty had been chosen because of where he worked and who owned it. Very old money was behind the crow's nest, and enough of it that its owners didn't mind losing some every month to keep the place going. It was a kind of eleemosynary institution, created to serve not culture and not Duke, but a thing called the purpose. And if Ty kept working there for another few decades, perhaps one of the owners would sit him down one day in the bolt hole and deign to tell him what exactly the purpose was. With all of that in his mind, he somehow slipped back into sleep and did not awaken until the sun was up. The spear carrier came within range and tossed them 3 ration packets from the glider's stores. Einstein woke up and consumed his as only a teenaged boy was capable of doing. Ty ate at a more measured rate, while keeping an eye on Kath too. She had awakened long enough to remove the lid from her meal and pick at some of the blander offerings. But this led directly to vomiting, dry heaves, and a return to sleep. They passed the day in a desultory long-range stare-down with the diggers, who grew fewer and more aggrieved as the hours wore on. "Do you have a theory yet?" Einstein asked him as they were consuming the midday ration toss.
"About what?"
"The pingers." Ty, having naught else to do, let his mouth run. "The girl's name, Sonar. I can think of a weird coincidence related to that." "Yes?" Einstein was all ears for anything related to Sonar tax law. "It's a technology they used before Zero. Undersea radar based on sound waves. They would send out pulses of sound called pings." "You think the pingers live under the sea?"
"It all fits. Except..."
"Except what?"
"Where the hell did they come from?"
"Survivors? Like the diggers?"
"I don't see how it's possible," Ty said.
None of the scouts who went out looking for Bard and Belid returned. It was beginning to raise the question of who was really holding whom hostage. The ones who'd gone missing had friends, parents, and children who soon became desperate to know what had become of them and began asking awkward questions of those in command. Late in the afternoon, The diggers were reinforced by a band of some 20 additional warriors coming up the valley, carrying dead animals on long sticks. The diggers all held a parley around their cook fire. After they had eaten their fill, Dono came up alone, using a short spear as a walking stick or a wizard's staff. The sun had gone down, so Tai heard him before he saw him.
"We carry out an exchange," Dono announced, "and you people get out of here without further casualties."
"Is that what you call murdering people?" Tai wanted to ask. Instead, he said,
"Very well. How would you like to proceed?"
"Well," Dono said, beginning to sputter a bit, "we need to be able to communicate with them, but everyone we send out disappears."
"Would you like me to do it?"
"Then you'll just run away."
"It is not necessary to talk face to face," Tai said.
"You have radios?"
Dono asked suspiciously. Radio. A queer old word. The diggers had searched them all, made sure they had no communication devices.
"No," Tai said.
He leaned back and reached into an open ration pack, took out a piece of bread, tore off a bit of it. Dual sparks all around shone in the retinas of grizzled crows. They'd brought a dozen of them on the glider, in modular cages made for traveling. The diggers had inadvertently released them, and they'd been hanging around the campsite ever since. They knew what Tai was doing, and were already jockeying for position, smacking one another with their wings and squawking. Tai held out his hand with a piece of bread on it, and almost before he'd unfurled his fingers, the morsel had been pecked out by a crow who was now regarding him intently.
"Belled. Bard," he said.
The normal procedure was to display a picture of the recipient, but these birds had some ability to recognize names and map them onto faces, and during spare moments on the journey, the seven had been training them.
"Our hosts wish to negotiate an exchange of prisoners."
Tai closed his hand and waved the bird away. It flapped off into the gloom, screaming the message. He looked at Dono and enjoyed the consternation on the digger's face.
"We should hear back soon," he said.
Dono turned without a word and strode back to the digger campfire. Half an hour passed. It became fully dark. The canids began howling. Tai looked up into the sky, expecting to see the habitat ring coming out. So did all the diggers. But the ring was not the only bright thing in the sky tonight. There was also a meteor shower. A strangely orderly one. It seemed to be heading directly for them. Dono came running back, accompanied by more spearmen, all in an ugly mood.
"Is this an attack force?" he demanded. "Coming to rescue you?"
"So," Tai said, "you know what those are?"
"The pods you used to fall out of orbit when you went to land a person quickly. Now answer my question."
"This is blue territory," Tai said, then held up a hand to suppress Dono's inevitable protest.
"According to treaty, if blue forces were coming to rescue us, they would simply fly over the mountains from Kayak, much easier than dropping people 40,000 kilometers from the habitat ring."
He was willing himself to maintain eye contact with Dono and to keep his voice as relaxed and conversational as he could manage. The spearmen had fanned out to form a ring around their little camp, aiming the points of their weapons inward. Einstein really didn't like that, and Tai could hear links of chain clicking through the loops on the younger man's collar as he edged closer.
"Who are they, then?" Dono demanded.
"By process of elimination," Tai said, "they are red."
"But you said you consider this blue territory."
"Yes." "You might be interested to know," Tai said, "that this makes it a breach of treaty and an act of war."
Dono stood gobsmacked. Tai was tempted to say, "Welcome to the modern world," but instead he added,
"You might wish to keep this in mind if you sign a treaty with them."
A grizzled crow landed on the ground nearby and addressed Tai.
"We are coming!"
That these drop pods were of military design was obvious from the way they came in. Fast. Each had a set of vanes, mounted near the top, that sprang out when it was a couple of thousand meters above the surface, slowing its fall. But not until the pod was just a few tens of meters above the ground did its retro-rockets come on. Not just one, but a circular array of thumb-sized solids that created a cylindrical piston of fire on which the pod eased to a stop, coming to light on a tripod of bug-like legs that deployed themselves at the last possible moment and absorbed the shock of contact. The first 13 drop pods landed in a nearly perfect circular formation, about a kilometer down the valley. As soon as they touched down, they sprang open. Their hatches faced inward. The pod ring thus presented nothing but armored black shells to any foes outside of it. Any foes inside were in for a bad time. Seconds later, a 14th pod landed in the center, and a man climbed out. On his signal, the 13 somersaulted out of their pods and rolled sideways onto their bellies, looking outward into the space beyond, which was now well illuminated by blinding lights shining from the back shells. In actual battle, the next procedure would have been to start killing anything they could see, but instead the leader shouted a command that caused all of them to stand up, holster their cats, and dust themselves off. 10 of the 13 were Neoanders. 3 others had the more normal, modern human look. Those, and the one in the middle, were likely B-types or betas, the most numerous of the Aiedan subraces. The peloton, for that was the Aiedan term for a unit of this size, adopted a parade rest position, facing outward and resisting the temptation to watch as 4 more drop pods landed in the space they had just circumscribed. The occupants of these were a little slower to climb out. It seemed evident that they were civilians who hadn't done it before. While they were doing so, another pod landed, this one outside the circle. It was of a somewhat different design, used to land cargo. The peloton moved forward to form a loose perimeter around this one. The civilians opened it and removed various items, most obviously a few sections of tubing that they snapped together to form a pole. To the top of this, they affixed a circular hoop, creating a rather more stylish and high-tech version of the circle-on-a-stick totem that the diggers favored. Below the hoop, they tied on a red, fork-tailed streamer, known in blue vernacular as the serpent's tongue, frequently used as a red emblem in battle or, more usually, athletic competitions. And below that, they attached a large white flag. The performance was so amusing that even Ty, who knew he should be attending to other things, was a little surprised when he noticed that the half-dozen digger warriors surrounding their little camp were all lying on the ground, twitching helplessly. This had occurred so recently that some of their handmade spears were still toppling to the ground. In one of those peculiar, focused insights that comes to one when things are happening very fast, he noticed that the leaf-shaped spearheads had been hand-forged, and wondered idly if the metal had been scavenged from the truck they'd excavated. Naturally, he looked toward the explosive device on the nearby cairn. He saw that the wires had been severed. A hand, the size of a dinner plate, appeared above the top of the cairn, scooped up the explosive charge, and hurled it into oblivion. Belid had materialized near the wooden stake, which he was examining in something like wonder. After trying its connection to the end of the chain, he knelt down, gripped it with both hands, and began pulling. Langobard, now that he dispensed with the explosive, loped over to join him. Squatting, he scooped away some dirt to get better purchase and added his strength. 0.5 meter of the stake suddenly emerged from the ground, causing both men to tumble back. From a semi-reclining position, Bard swatted at it with one hand, as if shooing away an insect, and it snapped off at ground level. Ty, Einstein, and Kath were still chained together, but free to move. Since Bard was now operating in a more stealthy mode, he was not surrounded by a whining complex of A-trains. Rather, he had gotten all of his flinks jacked together into a single long rope that was looped and draped around his torso in a complex pattern that Ty had seen before, and that he supposed had been developed by Neoanders over thousands of years. Ty reeled the stake fragment in, hand-over-handing the chain through his neck collar and grabbed it in both hands like a club. He used its free end to scatter the campfire and darken the encampment. Kath, still half in her sleeping bag, was up on all fours, vomiting. Bellad strode over to her, scooped one arm under her midsection, hoisted her up, and slung her over his shoulder. He had not really broken stride, and so the other two prisoners were now obliged to go with him. Langobard trailed the group, impulsively snatching up a spear. As a keepsake? It had not been the most surgical extraction in the history of warfare. It was very far from being the most cack-handed, however. More fighting might have ensued had the main encampment of diggers not been utterly transfixed by the approach of the Red delegation. Ty was just allowing himself to believe that they'd gotten away clean when he heard a voice from out of the dark, only a few meters away.
I found this!
Directly, the speaker was painted by a crossfire of red lasers from Bellad's and Bard's catapults. In the dark, it was impossible to see her face, but Ty had already recognized the voice.
Hold your fire, he said.
The psych stepped closer. Bard risked illuminating her with a dim light. She was holding the lump of explosive in her hand. It must have rolled down the slope toward the main digger encampment.
Sonar tax law, Ty said.
You remembered,
she exclaimed. Then, apparently, as some sort of explanation, she offered,
Volume 17.
Okay, Sonar, Ty said. You are free to go. Or you can come with us. As much as I would hate to deprive your folk of their knowledge of the last part of the S topics and the beginning of the T's, I recommend coming with us.
He was working out how to explain matters to Sonar without taking all night, but Sonar abruptly said,
Okay,
and in her scurrying way, fell into step with them.
You can leave that, Ty said, nodding at the lump of explosive.
A mixture of RDX with beeswax and vegetable oil, Sonar said helpfully. It will not detonate without...
I know, Ty said, but we don't need it.
Sensing eyes upon him, he looked toward the massive silhouette of Bard. The Neoander's face was in darkness, but Ty could guess that it bore an incredulous expression.
I'll explain later, Ty said.
They walked briskly uphill for several minutes, their view across and down the valley improving as they went. Far below them, the Red delegation had been ascending toward the glider encampment at a stately pace, following in the footsteps that the Seven had made yesterday. Quite clearly, they wanted to be as obvious as possible, and so they were advancing in a pool of brilliant illumination made by portable lanterns, which the member of the Peloton were aiming toward the center. The same goal, not seeming to sneak up on the diggers, might have been achieved simply by waiting a few hours and doing it in daylight. But that was just typical Blue thinking. They were doing it at night for the sheer drama and pageantry of it, this being the sort of thing that Red, by and large, was simply better at than Blue. Ty almost laughed out loud when they got to a place where they could get their first clear look at the approaching spectacle. He was comparing it in his mind to the pitiful show that the Seven had put on yesterday. Of course, the Seven had been surprised, so it wasn't a fair comparison. But the diggers would not be making allowances for fairness. What they were seeing was probably a lot closer to how their folk, stuck underground, might have been imagining this moment during the last 5,000 years. A tall Aiden with a mane of glossy black hair preceded the rest. He wore some kind of ceremonial robe that streamed in the cold wind draining down the valley and glowed warmly in the light shone on him by the peloton. Advancing with a measured tread, he held the hoop standard in an absurdly dramatic pose with his upper hand reversed so that the thumb was down and the palm faced forward. It was meaningless, but it looked great. A few paces behind him walked an older man with gray hair swept back from his high brow and a neatly trimmed beard. His robes were more subdued, but, once suspected, really smashing if you could see them up close. A gold chain around his neck supported a medallion on his chest. His right arm was extended to cradle the left hand of none other than Marge the Digger, whom he was escorting up the hill in the manner of a dad giving away the bride. She was wearing what she'd last been seen in, supplemented with a warmer garment thrown over her shoulders like a cape. It kept trying to fall off as she waved her free hand over her head, signaling to her digger kin that all was well. When they recognized her, they shouted words of greeting, and she waved the more vigorously. Her cape fell off and was replaced by one of the uniformed betas. Even at a distance, it was obvious that the standard-bearer and the one escorting Marge were Arateics, which was to say, Aedans of the first line of descent, presumably conceived as competitors to the children of Eve Dinah. They were tall and long-maned, with magnificent noses and excellent posture. A few paces behind Marge and the senior Arateic were a Camite and one of the Betas, walking abreast. They were joined by a pole about 2 meters long. Each of them supported an end in the crooks of her elbows. In the pole's center was a gleaming lump about the size of a person's head, which any spacer would recognize as a small nickel-iron asteroid, as common in space as dead leaves were on the reforested surface. But rare down here, even after the hard rain. Ariane must have told her higher-ups about the truck, what the excavation of its engine block said about the lengths that the diggers would go to in order to get their hands on a bit of metal, and how grateful they would be for such a gift. Or perhaps Ariane had been broadcasting the entire mission to Kyoto through some covert, encrypted channel. Anyway, it would make a better token of friendship than a busted shovel handle. Two of the members of the Peloton were musicians. At a certain point, one of them began to beat a drum that was harnessed to his midsection, and another began to play a melody on a shiny horn. Ty was convinced he'd heard it in the epic somewhere, but it took Bard to place it.
"Red of Heaven," he said. "It's what Rufus and his company were singing when they welded themselves in."
"Also known as Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah, or in the original Welsh, Cumranda," added Sonar Taxlaw.
"Fuck, these people are good," Ty exclaimed. "How long do you suppose they've been preparing this?" Bard asked. "They have been way ahead of us for months, maybe years," Ty said. "But having said that, there's little in what we're seeing that couldn't have been thrown together in a few hours."
"Confirmed," said Bellad.
He had let Kath gently to the ground, where she now lay in a fetal position curled about his shin. He was looking at the procession through optics.
"The ring at the top of the standard? It's an exercise hoop covered in silver tape. The white flag? A bedsheet."
"Do we even need to bother watching how this goes?" Bard asked.
And then he looked at Ty to give the answer. It had not been a rhetorical question. He was awaiting orders.
Bellad Tomov looked at him too.
"How is she?" Ty asked. "Pulse? Respiration okay?"
"I think it is the usual," Bellad said with a nod,
meaning that abrupt hormone shifts in Kath's system were giving her something akin to morning sickness. Her microbiome, the ecosystem of bacteria that lived in her gut and on her skin, had been thrown into disarray, and she was being colonized by any old germs, including ones from the diggers, that had never been exposed to a Moiran body.
"Can you put her on your back or something?"
Bellad nodded and dropped to one knee. He had been carrying a pack on his back. He emptied its contents on the ground and began slashing leg holes in its bottom corners so that Kath could just be inserted into it, like an infant into a carrier.
"We can't rule out that our guys will show up in force," Ty said, referring to Blue Military.
He looked south over the mountains, but didn't see anything coming. Nor would he, of course. Anything headed their way from Kayak would be running dark.
"Have you been in touch with them?"
"Yes," Bard said.
During this little pause, he had been rooting a multi-tool out of his belt. He approached Ty, who held out the broken stake. Bard got his tool clamped around the head of the bolt and began to twist it out. Ty nodded wearily. On one level, he had just asked a stupid question. But the diggers' attack, hell for that matter, their existence, had taken them by surprise. And since then he'd been preoccupied with being a prisoner under conditions so primitive as to verge on slapstick. He ought to have been thinking about the larger picture.
Blue might bomb this whole valley into the Stone Age. But probably not. It was already in the Stone Age. Bard and Bellet had gotten a message up to Denali, which was the closest major Teklin military habitat to 16630. Everyone of consequence in Blue would now be aware that the diggers existed, that the initial contact had been botched, and that there was a hostage situation. The Thor would have made it clear that Red was a step ahead of them. The descent of those drop pods, a few minutes ago, would have made it clearer. The brilliant pool of light in which the Red delegation moved was as much for the benefit of long-lensed video cameras peering down from orbit as for the diggers. It was a fait accompli that Red would make formal contact in about 30 seconds with the diggers, and that it would go a lot better than yesterday. Ariane would have prepped them, told them what to say. Yes, of course we accept your claim to the Earth's surface. Its justice is self-evident. We have plenty of room in orbit. No need for habitations on the planet. Of course, as you've already learned firsthand, you can't trust those people from Blue. We might be persuaded to install a discreet military presence just to keep them from encroaching on your territory. As long as we're there, some cultural exchange programs might be in order. We could offer medicine, dental care, technical advice in rebuilding your civilization. How may we be of assistance?
Blue isn't coming tonight, Ty said. It will just play into their hands.
He nodded down at the procession, which was only a few meters away from making first contact with an equally sized group of diggers.
But some members of that peloton might come after us. They'd look like heroes if they could march us back into camp in shackles.
Or carry our heads in on spikes, Bard suggested in a casual tone.
Shh, Ty said, with a glance toward the newest member of their band. But the psych looked unconcerned.
Sonar, Ty said. We are going to have to move. Get away from any patrols those guys might send out while it's still dark. Can you do that? Move rapidly over rough terrain in the dark.
Sure, Sonar said, a little too blithely for Ty's taste. But before he could press her, she added,
Guess we'll be going north, then?
Why do you say that?
Because the main group is going south. Probably as soon as the sun is up.
How far south were they thinking of going?
As it was, they were less than 100 kilometers from the southern coast of Beringia.
To the sea,
Sonar said, as if this were self-evident.
What's going to happen then?
The question seemed simple enough, but it led to an outburst of chuckles from Sonar.
They're going to wonder what became of me, that's what,
she said, when she could get her mirth under control.
They're probably wondering that already, Einstein remarked.
No, I mean they'll be needing me, then.
Why? Einstein asked.
It's a riddle.
The bolt had been removed now, freeing the end of the chain, which Ty pulled clear of his collar. He opened the thing up and tossed it on the ground. The gesture caught the eye of the psych, who probably saw it as a shocking way to treat valuable metal. Ty was now free, holding the massive stake fragment and managing to control a certain natural impulse to bash her head in. This was not a time for riddles. Einstein got the chain out of his own collar, then carried it in the direction of Kath, so that he could help her.
The purpose of your expedition, before we blundered into your path, that is, was to get to the edge of the water and make contact with the Pingers, Ty ventured.
Pingers?
Bard asked.
Ty ignored him, maintaining his focus on the psych.
You, by virtue of your mastery of Volume 17 of the Encyclopedia Britannica, are the closest thing your folk have to an expert on the only technology capable of summoning them.
Oh, I'm an expert on other topics as well, Sonar said. Sophism, South Carolina, Pope Sylvester II?
Ty decided to let the witticisms go by without positive or negative reinforcement.
What were you guys going to say to them?
It's they who want to talk to us, Sonar said. They left us a message, a cairn on the beach. We are coming to respond.
The ensuing silence lasted a long time, long enough for the final stanza of Bread of Heaven to stop reverberating from the mountain walls, long enough for the Aiedan leader's opening greeting, written and pronounced in flawless pre-Zero English, to move through a solid paragraph of awe-inspiringly sycophantic salutations, long enough for Bard to get the unchained Cath socketed into his backpack.
"We move south," Ty announced. "Bard, you keep pace with the psych. If she slows down, carry her. I'm going to need your radio."
"My what?" Bard exclaimed.
"An electromagnetic communications device," Sonar began, but Ty cut her off.
"The thingamajibber you used to talk to Denali. I'm going to tell them we have a second chance."
"A second chance to do what?"
"To make friends with the natives of this planet."
They crested a pass in the coastal range the following day and began making their way down toward the sea. When the going became easy enough to allow for something like normal conversation, Ty asked,
"How many psychs are there in total?"
Sonar's little head snapped around, like a bird's, to regard him curiously. She would never look you directly in the eye, but she would lurk in your peripheral vision and sneak peeks all day long.
"I know," Ty said. "As many as there are volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. But I don't know what that number is, because we no longer have copies of it lying around."
"Well, there are the 10, the 19, and the 1, Sonar said. "The 10 are the Micropedia, many short articles. The 19 are the Macropedia, longer, more in-depth articles. The 1 is the Propedia, the outline."
"Which category do you belong to?"
Einstein, walking ahead of them down the slope, wheeled around.
"She already told us she was Volume 17.
Normally good-natured, he was being unusually chippy all of a sudden. He returned his attention to the rocky terrain in front of him, displaying a flushed neck beneath his ponytail.
"Excuse me," Ty said.
Then, turning back to the psych, he asked,
"Is that just luck of the draw, or—"
"No!"
"Of course not."
"The older psychs started me on smaller books to evaluate me."
"When? At what age did they start you?"
"When it was decided that I was not a breeder."
Einstein turned around again, this time so suddenly that he lost his footing and fell on his ass. The reaction was so outsized that Ty had to look away from it lest he break out laughing. But this brought Langobard into his line of sight, and the Neoander was in similar trouble. The two men had to stop walking and turn their backs on each other for a few moments just to keep their composure.
"If I can just anticipate some questions that I believe may be uppermost in young Einstein's mind," Langobard said, "would it be untoward of me to inquire what precisely makes you not a breeder?"
The psych shrugged, staring down the mountain toward the Pacific Ocean, as if she had not given the topic very much thought recently.
"I know not. Of mean stature? Nothing special to behold? On the spectrum?"
"For context," Ty asked, "how many young women out of 10 are designated as breeders?"
4, maybe?"
"So being a non-breeder is more common than being a breeder," Ty said, for Einstein's benefit.
"Of course, now that we have come out of the hole, and we have more space, more people are breeding," Sonar said. "I speak of how it was 10 years ago."
She had earlier told them that she was 16.
"Okay, so they think they know enough about you at the age of 6 to make that determination. They start you out on easier books, then what?"
"If you can read at all, you just start reading the whole psych."
"And so that's why you know stuff about radio and epicanthic folds and other topics not in Volume 17.
"Yes. You have to read the whole thing. By 10, they decide whether you are Micropedia or Macropedia quality."
"Is one of those more prestigious than the other?"
"Of course!"
Sonar exclaimed, without bothering to say which was which.
I'll bet the Micropedia is just like memorizing a bunch of trivia, Einstein essayed, somewhat dangerously in case he guessed wrong. But love had made him impetuous.
Yes, you have to be able to hold more in your head to be one of the 19,
Sonar said, favoring Einstein with a warm gaze.
So did you have to kill the previous Sonar tax law in single combat or something?
Tai asked, and immediately thought better of it, since in general diggers did not seem to have a well-developed sense of humor. Einstein threw him a mean look.
No, not in this case,
the psych said politely, leaving open the question of in what cases the diggers did actually employ such methods.
My mentor was Salon Congreve.
Now that is a lovely and distinguished name, Langobard exclaimed. Volume 3?
4, she said, with a note of surprise in her voice, as if not quite able to believe that someone could not know this.
Do the original paper copies still exist?
Tai asked.
Oh, yes, Sonar said. But we handle them only on ceremonial occasions. We work with handwritten copies.
Rufus must have squirreled away a lot of paper.
Tons of it, said the psych. Acid-free, 100% cotton.
During their nighttime escape over the mountains, they'd had little time for such conversations, and so their knowledge of digger culture was still spotty. Some reasonable guesses could be made simply from the known history of the hard rain. The phase known as the cooling off had not begun until some 3,900 years after Zero, when the human race's efforts to police the lunar rubble belt had finally paid off with a sharp fall-off in the number of bolides striking the surface. Until then, the diggers had been obliged to maintain a small, steady population in the space that Rufus had provided. Expansion of the whole had been limited by the fact that it was a sealed system, with no place to put spoil, the quantities of loose material created by digging. As anyone knew who had ever dug a hole in the ground with a shovel, the size of the dirt pile, the spoil, was always larger than the volume of the hole. They'd been able to dump some soil down a deep and otherwise useless shaft, but once this had been filled, they'd been unable to expand their living space, for as long as the hard rain had made a direct connection to the outside too dangerous to be contemplated. So during that phase, well over 3,000 years, they had devoted all of their energies to maintaining a community of several hundred people. Hence the rigid controls on breeding. Thanks to their psychs, they knew everything about contraception, but they had no ability to manufacture things like condoms and pills, so that lore was mostly useless. The limitations on breeding were enforced by moral strictures, by segregation of the sexes, and by surgical sterilization. This, like all of their surgery, was performed without chemical anesthesia once they'd run out of drugs, which occurred fairly soon after Zero. Apparently they had gotten rather good at acupuncture and at biting down on things. The reduction in the intensity of the hard rain would have been obvious to them on one level, since they could hear the impacts through the walls of the hole. On another level, it was easy to miss, since even dramatic changes spanned generations. But they had kept meticulous records of the frequency and intensity of strikes, and so they recognized the downward trend in the late fourth millennium. When it was adjudged safe, they drilled an adit, a horizontal tunnel, out the side of the mountain until it broke out of a slope that they guessed was steep enough to have shed ejecta, preventing the buildup of rocky debris that now covered most of Earth's surface to a considerable depth. That much had been true, but the debris at the base of the mountain had piled higher than they had expected, almost high enough to block the opening of their adit. Anyway, it had worked well enough that they had been able to push spoil out of it and thus begin expanding the hole. The atmosphere was still far from breathable, so they'd been obliged to keep it sealed when they were not actively dumping stuff out of it to prevent fumes from seeping in and poisoning the atmospheric system that they had looked after so meticulously for nearly 4,000 years. This system, it seemed, was similar in principle to those used on space habitats. Carbon dioxide was removed by a combination of chemical scrubbers and green plants. Both of these required energy. The scrubber chemical had to be heated to drive off the CO2 it had absorbed, and the plants required light. Since they were cut off from the sun,
they got their energy geothermically, using works that Rufus and the others of his generation had sunk deep into the roots of the mountain. The maintenance of this system had been the full-time occupation of everyone in the hole for the entire time they'd been down there. When they had neared the end of their stock of light-emitting diodes, they had revived the art of making light bulbs, consulting the psych for particulars, blowing artisanal glass envelopes, and winding the filaments by hand. Likewise with many other things they had found themselves in need of. Ty, not really an expert on technology, made little headway in trying to imagine the particulars. Someone of a more technical bent might have devoted weeks to debriefing Sonar Tax Law and extracting every last detail about how they had managed to get along with just the stuff available to them underground. More important for present purposes was to get a general understanding of the diggers' culture and why they behaved as they did. The requirement for a steel-spined authoritarian culture was obvious. Any power structure, one of whose main goals was to prevent humans from fucking each other at will, had to be extremely formidable. Had these people been living in, for example, the agricultural paradise of the Nile Delta, they might have been able to get away with some mazy religious dogma as the basis for that system. But instead they had been trapped within a large machine that would kill them all if allowed to go on the fritz, and so they had been obliged to develop a culture in which engineering became their duch. Their finite supply of tungsten, stockpiled by wise Rufus, had to be stretched and husbanded so that their descendants thousands of years in the future would be able to manufacture light bulbs to grow plants to make food and air, and so on and so forth in every particular of how these people lived their daily lives. 30 people, the 10, the 19, and the 1, were at any given time psychs. Another 30 were toiling as their apprentices. Others played specific roles such as breeder mom, glassblower, acupuncturist, filament winder, potato nurturer, pump fixer. Structurally, culturally, it was very like a Bronze Age theocracy, but without any trace of God or the supernatural. To that point, it was not radically different from the subcultures of many first and second millennium space habitats, which, at least for a little while, gave Ty the idea that he could get a quick handle on the digger culture. But that fantasy soon evaporated. Those early spacers had been living in cramped conditions, yes, and they had been just as dependent upon technology as the diggers in their hole. So, of course, there were some common features in the two cultures. But spacers had always been able to look outside to see what the situation was, and, at least after a couple of thousand years of hunkering down in especially large rocks, to venture forth and do something about it. Even in their most desperate hours, they had always expected to re-inherit the Earth. The diggers' only way of knowing their situation and their fate was to listen to loud noises, tally them on acid-free, 100% cotton paper, and, every few years, compare the tally with a similar one made by some ancestor a couple of hundred years previously. For the first 4,000 years, hope of a better future must have been seen as sheer folly. Worse than that, as an active betrayal of digger principles, since people with hopes were apt to become profligate in spending resources and taking risks. Which all made for a picture of those first 4 millennia that was as clear as it was bleak. But change would come hard to a society like that one. What was most interesting to Ty was what had begun to go on within that society when they'd punched the spoil at it to the surface and begun to expand their underground domain. Their day-to-day lives would not have changed much, but they'd have had at least the abstract possibility that their civilization might expand, that more people might be able to breed. All of that had occurred more than 1,000 years ago. The whole had grown to the point where it could support a population of 2,000. Then, around 4,700, when the atmosphere had become breathable, they'd been able to take it up to 10,000. All still beneath the surface, however, since there'd been little for them above it. At some point, the committee, which was what they called their ruling council, must have become aware that vast numbers of humans were living in space and actively prosecuting the terraform. They could simply have walked out onto the surface and sent out some kind of an SOS at that point. Instead, they had made a positive decision to conceal themselves, to hide their spoil dumps, to shun communication with the spacers. The central question, then, was why they had made such a choice. Sonar tax law wasn't much help in explaining it. When Ty or the others asked questions, she offered non-responsive answers that told of a subterranean culture in which such things were never spoken of. It was clear, however, that having made that decision, the committee would have to explain it, justify it, and perpetuate it by painting the spacers as alien mutants, and furthermore by cultivating a finely developed sense of racial grievance against the cowards who had run away and abandoned them. All of which had been on vivid display during the brief and disastrous conversation between Doc and the Digger contingent. Between Einstein's personal knowledge of the terrain, geographical folklore stored in the Sykes encyclopedic mind, and Bellid's digital map, they knew generally where to go at any particular moment. What made it difficult was negotiating obstacles in the terrain and steering clear of large animals. The latter group might, in theory, include red military patrols, but they had no reason to believe that they were being pursued yet. Why would Red bother? Marching some blue prisoners back in chains might score them some points with their new digger friends, but having chased them off into the darkness was nearly as effective. Perhaps more so, given the importance to the diggers of the meme of spacers as cowards. Ty considered explaining to the psych that if her group of diggers had turned up on the west side of 16630, making the same preposterous territorial claims, Red, instead of approaching them with music and nuggets of space iron, would simply have vaporized them. But burdening the poor girl with that awareness wasn't going to help. They holed up in a pocket of shelter beneath a leaf of rock about the size of a football field that had been driven like a blade into the southern slope of a coastal mountain. There they consumed a day recovering from their exertions and waiting out a snowstorm while communicating in short bursts with a transmitter on the Denali habitat. Blue military dropped a pod through the storm. Kath awakened long enough to announce that it had landed just down the slope from them. Bard stomped out there, his huge feet acting like snowshoes, and returned a quarter of an hour later, dragging it behind him. He then stood for a few minutes contemplating Kath. Her sickness had abated, but she woke up now only to eat, eliminate, or make Delphic pronouncements. The pod contained food, fuel, ammunition, robots, and equipment for snow travel that stood them in good stead during the next day as they descended out of the mountains toward the southern coast. Much of this happened under cover of the heavy clouds that almost always blanketed this part of the world, and so if anyone was watching them, it had to be directly, by actually following them around, or with flying robots. But now they had flying robots of their own that could alert them to the presence of both. Since those remained quiet, they felt reasonably certain that they were not being tracked, except by large canids, who tended to make their presence obvious by howling a lot. Because of them, the next night was a restless one, and led to an early departure and a final day of hiking that rapidly developed into a pell-mell descent out of the alpine zone and toward the Pacific. During their lunch break, they spied a trio of single-person gliders, inflatables like the one Kath too had taken on her survey mission, dipping and darting along the coast from the general direction of Kayak. As these carried blue markings and were transmitting blue codes, Bellid felt comfortable divulging their position. Minutes later, the gliders had touched down in an expanse of heather a few hundred meters below them. Their occupants climbed out, eviscerated their cargo holds, and began to deflate their gliders so that they could be rolled up. Most of that work ended up being done by a Teklin, shorter and more lithe than Bellid. This left the other two new arrivals free to approach. One of them was a Kamite, whose gait and posture were more expressive of male than of female characteristics, and so Ty made a mental note to employ male pronouns until and unless the Kamite requested otherwise. He wore one of the utilitarian coveralls employed by survey personnel, with red cross patches on the chest and shoulder, marking him as a medic. The other was a middle-aged Ivan, dressed in civilian clothes, marginally more posh than might be expected in the wilderness of Beringia, but suited to the conditions. Regarding them from a more sheltered position overlooking the meadow, Ty had mixed feelings. Any assistance was, of course, welcome. He had known better than to expect a thunderous show of force. Blue's high political councils, having been caught badly off guard, and having lost the first round to their red counterparts, would be assessing the situation and thinking about their options. For public consumption, they were probably characterizing the Seven as a plain vanilla survey team that had fallen victim to an ambush. They didn't want to undercut that story now by sending in an undeniably military force. The name printed on the Kamite's uniform was Hope, which probably meant that, like many Kamites, he only used one name. Bent under a medical pack, he went directly to Kath. Bellad and Bard were descending to the meadow to help the Teclan pack up the gliders. The Ivan singled out Ty from a distance and approached him. The family name on his uniform was Issa, and he introduced himself as Arjun. The former was an acronym frequently seen in the background of shots in the epic, standing for European Space Agency. It had become a common name. Ty considered asking Arjun flat out who he was and what he did for a living that caused him to show up in circumstances like these. But he knew it would get him nowhere. The man would have some bland answer queued up. He was probably some kind of high-powered intelligence analyst with 5 advanced degrees.
"How's all this playing up on the ring?" Ty asked him. "Do I even want to know?"
The mere question caused Arjun to break eye contact and gaze out over the sea.
"That bad?" Ty prompted him.
"You know the Arataics," Arjun said.
"They made it into grand opera, eh?"
"That's as good a description as any. I'm still coming to grips with it. Of course, we rarely see content from the red side of the ring."
"Just the propaganda," Ty said.
"Yes, and when we see that, we have a laugh at the overwrought style, the Baroque production values, while harboring an inner sense of anxiety that some people within Blue
might actually believe their shit."
"Exactly."
"So Red did broadcast it?"
Arjun nodded.
"Live, to the whole ring."
"Sorry I missed the show. We bolted before the actual contact. It seemed like as good a time as any."
"That was a fine tactic," Arjun replied, "and saved you a great deal of annoyance."
"How do you mean?"
Arjun turned to look directly at him.
"The diggers," he said, "were as receptive to Red's overtures as they were hostile to yours."
Ty felt something in his chest, the awareness that he had failed and that people knew it. It was not a feeling to which he was accustomed, and he did not like it.
"So," he said, "the diggers ate it up?"
"They signed an alliance with Red on the spot. Red recognized their claim to the entire land surface of Earth and urged Blue to follow suit."
"Just as a matter of basic human decency," Ty said sourly.
"Of course. The saber rattling began the next day."
Issa Arjun broke off as he noticed and focused on Sonar Taxlaw, who was standing next to Einstein, who was telling her how the gliders worked. Ty had grown used to it. All those two did the whole time they were awake was explain things to each other. But it was new to Arjun.
"She's the..." Arjun said, and trailed off.
Ty tried to put himself in Arjun's shoes, laying eyes on a rootstock human for the first time in his life, seeing someone who was clearly human and yet not of any identifiable human race, thinking about all that her ancestors had lived through.
"Yeah," Ty said.
Arjun managed to snap out of his reverie and looked back at Ty. "The narrative being put out is that you abducted her."
"Of course."
Einstein said something funny. The psych laughed and leaned into him affectionately. His arm found its way around her waist, the hand sliding down to the hip.
"Are those two..." Arjun began.
"Fucking? Not yet. But only because we've been on the run."
"The diggers, from what intelligence we've been able to scrape together, believe in strict gender roles and..."
"Not fucking. Yeah. I'll talk to Einstein. Tell him not to fuck her."
But you didn't...
abduct her? No, she just tagged along. Sensing doubt, or at least curiosity from the Ivan, Ty continued, and more would do given the same chance. The transition to surface life is putting their culture through a blender, which is why their leaders are being so reactionary. Arjun nodded.
And how's your Moiran?
Ty sighed. She saw Doc and Memmi die and suffered a blunt force trauma to her arm and was forced to draw her cat and to use it. As soon as it happened, she went into what I'm guessing is a classic potesh. This was military jargon for post-traumatic epigenetic shift.
That is confirmed, said Hope, who seemed to have finished an initial scan of Kath's vital signs. Higher metabolism and hyperacute senses are observable. Her microbiome is a mess. I'm tuning it up with probiotic supplements that'll be a better fit with her new phenotype. Suggested by the nausea are big hormone shifts, possibly predictive of some future...
testosterone poisoning? Ty suggested, finishing Hope's thought.
Hope responded with a diffident nod of the head.
Ty turned his attention back to Arjun. So 3 billion people just learned that the Diggers exist. How are they taking it?
Well, obviously it is a sensational bit of news, Arjun said. People are intensely curious.
He turned his head again to study sonar tax law. As am I admit it. Does the general public know how badly the first contact went wrong? Ty asked.
None of the identities of your 7 are public knowledge. Certainly no one has the faintest idea that who Noah had anything to do with it.
So Red hasn't been trumpeting that.
It wouldn't be to Red's advantage as I see it, Arjun said. Now that they are allied with the Diggers, they want to make the Diggers out to be sympathetic. Revealing that they killed Hu Noah and his nurse would hardly serve that end.
So we are just being made out to be some sort of anonymous thug squad. The Diggers chased us off with help from Red. We abducted a hostage as we were running away.
Arjun looked him in the eye. No intelligent person in Blue believes that, of course.
But Blue hasn't put out a countervailing narrative yet, either.
It isn't Blue's strong suit, Arjun sighed. Never has been, right? We're technocrats. We make decisions like engineers, which doesn't always line up with what people imagine they want.
Are you speaking of Blue in general? Ty asked. Or Rio in particular? Using the name of the Ivan Central Habitat as synecdoche for its culture.
Both. A Blue mentality that places us at the top of the decision-making pyramid. There's a reason why the very few Aiedans who have become prominent in Blue have been musicians, actors, artists.
They're supplying something our culture lacks, Ty said.
You were supposed to supply it, Arjun said, meaning, as Ty understood, the Dainin race. And you did, during the heroic age.
Ty could feel a not altogether cheerful smile on his face. By actually doing things, you mean, he said, as opposed to pretending to do them in made-up entertainment programs.
You know what, though? It's all entertainment, real or made-up. It's stuff that people watch on screens or VARPs. Red gets that.
Well, Ty said, maybe we can continue the discussion in my bar if we get out of this. But the bottom line for now, if I'm hearing you right, is that, narrative-wise, Red is killing us.
We have been a little distracted, Arjun said, showing a bit of defensiveness for the first time.
By what Red did, you mean, Ty said.
He was referring to the insertion of the Peloton, Marge's glorious return, and the lovey-dovey stuff between their delegation and the Diggers. Arjun did not out-and-out disagree, but the look on his face was a bit impatient, the smart teacher working with a slow pupil. More by what they've been doing, for a while now.
Well, Ty said, as a mere bartender, I wouldn't know about anything other than what is on the news feeds. So tell me, what have they been doing?
What do you know about the Kulak?
What any civilian lacking a security clearance would know, Tai answered carefully. People are assumed to be living in the fist part of it. Kulak was Russian for fist. In this context, it denoted an irregular lump of nickel iron some 30 kilometers across. 150 years ago, Red had moved it from the Kamchatka boneyard to a position above the Makassar Strait, where it had orbited ever since. Like a loosely clenched fist, it had a cavity down the middle, a tunnel now presumed to be lined with rotating habitats. Red's answer to the Great Chain. Then there's the rigging and spars whatnot surrounding that, Tai went on. For the fist, viewed from a distance, seemed to be tangled in a sparse web of cables, like a seed in a spider web. Above and below, to the nadir and zenith sides, these converged on hard points to which the long cables extending down to Earth's surface and up to the counterweight, the anti-Makassar, were attached. Sonar tax law, a few meters away, had been engaged in a public display of affection with Einstein, but withdrew slightly and turned her head to listen. Tai had grown accustomed to her ways. It was because he had said spars. That was between sonar and tax law in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and thus belonged to her domain of knowledge. During their hike over the mountains and down the other side, she had turned out to be well-informed, at least by troglodyte standards, about space exploration and the sun. So it had been easy to bring her up to speed on the last 5,000 years off-planet developments. She now began to drift toward Tai. Einstein followed her, as if his eyes were connected to her butt cheeks with fishhooks. Oblivious to all of this, for he had his back to it, Arjun was regarding him coolly, expecting more. Tai went on. The part on the surface, their answer to cradle, we don't know much about. They've been building it under the sea. They call it the gnomon, Arjun informed him. Then he spelled the word out. What does it mean? It used to be the thing that stood up in the middle of a sundial to cast the shadow, aligned with the Earth's axis. Tai considered it. Interesting choice of words. It's big, Tai. Much bigger than cradle. There's a reason they've been building it in the ocean, partly to hide it from us, and partly because it's too large to construct on terra firma. How big are we talking about, exactly? There is only so much I'm at liberty to say, Arjun said. Then he drew out a tablet and began tapping at it, pulling up a world map, panning and zooming toward the mess of islands between Southeast Asia and Australia. But just look at this and tell me what you see. He handed it to Tai.
Southeast Asia!
Exclaimed the psych, who had drawn close enough to see all of this over Arjun's shoulder.
Is there anything you would care to know of it? Or of Sulawesi? Or of Sri Lanka?
The Ivan regarded her with fascination.
I don't need to look, Tai said. I know what's there. The equator runs through all of that and rarely crosses over the land, and Red never stops whining about it.
Not true. Sumatra, said the psych.
A big island, to be sure, Tai said, but not a continent. Do you remember, Sonar, what I told you about how the eye works? What cradle does?
Touches the equator, she returned.
And only the equator, which is great if you control Africa and South America, which Blue does, but most of Red's territory lies north or south of the line.
Sonar wasn't going to be talked down so easily.
Singapore is close, she said, and that is connected to Asia.
The former location of Singapore is close, yes, but not on the equator. It's 1 or 2 degrees north. Cradle can't dock there.
And that one detail, more than anything else, is what infuriated the Aiedans about the design of the eye and cradle, Arjun put in. Sensing Einstein behind her, the psych leaned comfortably back against him, and started rattling off facts, her default mode of social interaction.
Aiedans, she said. The ABC hierarchy. Aretaics, Betas, Kamites.
Kamites are a different race, Einstein reminded her.
Oh, yeah.
The relationship of the A and the B to the C is more akin to symbiosis.
Ty and Einstein exchanged a wry look. Oblivious, Sonar Taxlaw gazed down the hill toward Langobard.
Neoanders, and two more, the smart ones and the crazy ones.
Jinns and Ekstats, Einstein said. They don't get out much. Arjun's fascination with seeing a rootstock human had given way to impatience. He focused on Ty again.
This is old history, of course, he said, but never forgotten by some people. Way back when the Eye was being designed, I'm talking 1,000 years ago, there were alternative schemes proposed. The one we ended up with was simplest, easiest to build with what people had back then. The Eye, the big rock, and a small cradle with sockets on the equator. Great for access to South America and Africa. Almost useless, however, in the stretch of the equator under the habitats where Aiedans, half of the Kamites, and most of the Julians lived.
What later became Red, Einstein put in, for Sonar Taxlaw's benefit. One of the reasons Red later coalesced and built such a strong counter-identity to Blue was their sense of grievance over this decision. We should have waited, they said. We could have had something much more useful than Cradle. Arjun zoomed in on Indonesia and dragged out a skinny rectangle, straddling the equator and spanning most of Red's latitudes. If instead of Cradle, we had made something in the shape of a long arc, spanning a greater distance north-south, it might have connected with Asia down here, where Singapore used to be. And here, it could touch the northern Cape of New Guinea. And New Guinea could be connected to Australia by dropping enough rocks into the shallows between them.
A long arc, aligned with the Earth's axis, casting a shadow on the ground, Ty said, nodding. A gnomon.
It would have to be huge, Einstein exclaimed. Arjun nodded. Plans for it were drawn up, studies commissioned on how it might be constructed, in orbit or on the surface. It was deemed too ambitious. So wiser heads prevailed, said Arjun. Or so it seemed at the time, and we built what we built. We can always make something bigger later, they said. But it didn't turn out that way. Blue forgot about it. Red didn't. Their Jinns put as much effort into thinking about it as our Ivans put into epigenetics. As soon as they closed the border and put up the 2 turnpikes, they went to work.
What have they been doing that whole time?
Smiting the Torres Strait with an unceasing storm of bolides, said Sonar Taxlaw, pointing to the narrows where Australia's northern cape almost poked New Guinea in the belly. Filling it in, damming the currents, making a wall against those that swim in the sea.
Arjun nodded. Then his head snapped around to focus on the psych. He stared at her intently for a moment, then looked at Ty.
Did you... he began.
Not a word, Ty said.
Einstein, did you tell her about Red's illegal terraforming operation here? And he tapped the same place on the map.
First I've heard of it, Einstein said.
Sonar, Arjun said. How did you know about that?
The Pingers told us, Sonar said.
Who the hell are the Pingers?
The people we are going to talk to, Sonar said.
Bellet and Bard had been assisting the Teclan. Those three now approached, carrying the glider packs. They set them down and began camouflaging them under such foliage as was available in this place. Scrubby bushes that had been socked into the brow of the slope to stabilize it and provide refuge for small animals. Ty got the feeling, from clues in the Teclan's physique and general style of movement, that he was some manner of snake-eater. When it became evident to the Teclan that the two larger men were better than he was at uprooting plants and moving dirt, this man left them to finish the task and approached. Tucked under his left arm was a container matching the general size and shape of those still used, in Chainhattan, to transport pizza. Dangling from that hand was a roughly cubical equipment case. With his free right hand, he exchanged salutes with Ty and identified himself as one Roscos Yur. He then set the 2 parcels in front of Ty and backed away from them.
Thank you, Ty said.
You're welcome, sir.
Why, Arjun asked, did you want those? Do you have any idea what it costs to get them here?
This psych can explain along the way, Tai said.
Arjun held his gaze on Tai for a moment, then glanced away with a diffident nod. Roscoe's Yor, by contrast, looked hard at him and wouldn't stop looking. After a few moments of this, Tai felt obliged to meet the Teclan's eye. Now that Tai could scan this man's insignia more carefully, he could see that he was part of a unit stationed at Nunavak, one of the forward blue outposts right up against the border. It was a byword for remote and isolated. It made Kayak seem like a metropolis, full of snake-eaters always being sent off on crazy missions.
That's not really what he's asking, sir, said Roscoe Sjor. He's really asking, who the fuck are you?
Sergeant Major Yor, Arjun said, in a tone of protest. But Yor would not be stopped.
And don't tell us you're a bartender, sir.
The late Doctor Who handpicked Mr. Lake for inclusion in the Seven, Arjun pointed out.
And now he's ramrodding this...
Yor looked about at the group and gave out an incredulous snort.
I don't even know how to describe it. Ragtag makes it sound like more than it is.
He let them out of a difficult situation, Arjun said.
A difficult situation for which he's partly responsible, sir, Yor shot back.
And at the moment he knows more about the diggers and the situation on the ground than anyone. I assume he requested those objects for a reason, which will be explained as we go.
Tai held up a hand.
Sergeant Major Yor doesn't trust me, because my allegiance isn't clear to him.
Fair enough.
Yor's face softened a little, and his gaze flicked to one side for a moment. Taking advantage of this break in the stare-down, Tai turned to face Issa Arjun. The Ivan made the tiniest movement that was still recognizable as shaking his head no. Once he was certain that Tai had caught it, he looked at Roscoe's Yor.
Sergeant Major, Arjun said quietly. There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Yor snorted.
Is that a fancy way of saying it's above my pay grade, sir?
Yes.
I just want to know if it's some kind of fucking Duke shit, sir.
Oh, is that all? Tai asked. Why didn't you say so?
No, Arjun said, the tension suddenly gone from his voice. There's no Duke involved.
Because that bar he works for,
it's not connected with any established coupole.
Then who the hell is it connected with, sir?
Yor demanded.
I made some inquiries with friends of mine in Intel. That bar makes no fucking sense as a business proposition. Its ownership structure is unusual. Connections to Red, I'm told.
One of the owners happens to be of part Aiden ancestry, Tai admitted. But be careful of making unwarranted assumptions about where his loyalties lie.
Does this have something to do with the purpose? Roscoe Sjor demanded.
Neither Tai nor Arjun answered. After a few moments of this silence, Yor heaved a sigh, then continued in a more moderate tone.
Never mind. I see it now. It's some kind of purpose thing, above my pay grade. You should have just told me.
He drew himself up and saluted.
What are my orders, sir?
We march to the sea, Tai said, following the Sykes' directions and moving as fast as we can. Complicating matters is that our Moirin may have to be carried.
Actually, said Langobard,
who had been loping in their direction and was now in earshot,
we may have to work rather hard to keep up with her.
He extended one long arm, pointing down the slope of the meadow. The first thing they all saw was the huge form of Belid charging downhill at the near sprint that, as they all knew, he could maintain for hours. Far ahead of him, then, they saw Kath Amalthova III moving even faster. Hope's drugs and probiotics had settled Kath III's mood a bit and reduced the nausea to the point where she could almost ignore it. This had been resolving on its own, but she was glad of any pharmaceutical assistance she could get. Her body had become ravenous, and she needed to keep her food down. But the most important drug in her system right now, so important that Hope had strapped a little pump to Cath3's arm, the better to keep dribbling it in, was one designed to home in on her amygdala and put the brakes on any slow neurological train wreck that might be underway there in reaction to the trauma she had seen 4 days ago. As such, it was reaching her brain a few days too late, but apparently it was one of those better-late-than-never things. It might help interrupt a vicious cycle in which her brain would keep replaying that little horror movie over and over, deepening the damage a little bit each time. The fact that she'd spent so much time asleep might also be helping her in that regard. Some tangible and biologically measurable benefit might be accrued to her as a result of having spent most of that time physically strapped to Bellad, her cheek to his shoulder, all but sucking him into her nostrils. For his part, the Teclan had shown no particular reaction to having an indolent, vomit-scented coma patient on his back during the day and curled up against his belly during the night. The two of them had still never had sex, but she feared now that once she was cleaned up and feeling better, she would be on him like a succubus. It was a well-known Potesh symptom, which had produced colorful and legendary results in Moiran communities that had survived collective trauma. But since having rampant sex with everything that moved wasn't really an option today, she sought other outlets for her surging physical energy. The hike from the meadow down to the sea was longer than it had appeared, and she ended up ranging far in front of the others, obliging Bellad to push himself hard just to keep her in sight. She could not see him because he was behind her, but she could sense his footfalls through the ground. She could hear his breathing and the faint clicking of the ambots that he carried on his person, and when the wind was from behind, she could smell the institutional wipes that he had been using for hygiene, and the detergent that had been used to clean his uniform, the lubricant on his cat, his most recent meal. Her ranging so far out in front of the others was partly a way to burn off a physical energy that threatened to make her crazy, but as much an effort to get into a place where she was not taking in an equal amount of sensory data from everyone in the group. One was enough. She stormed through a hedge of whippy plants that had been seeded in a dune above the beach and broke out onto the wet sand. Waves were breaking half a kilometer out and washing up toward her in fizzing sheets. The smell in her nostrils spoke of an incalculable density of marine life, akin to what she had scented when she had stood on the top of the bridge in Cradle, but much more finely resolved now. This despite the chemically induced suppression of her amygdala. Without Hope's drugs in her system, she might have spiraled into a sort of panic attack. As it was, she felt her body overheating and looked down at her bare arms as if expecting them to crack open like sausages on a grill. Dropping from a run to a stride, she marched straight down the beach, peeling off clothes as she went and depositing them in a ragged career over her footprints. Soon, but not soon enough, the surf was washing her ankles, then her shins. She dropped to her knees and let herself topple forward into an onrushing wave that caught her fall and let her down easy. Naked, she was floating face down in the water, whose icy cold only made the exposed parts of her skin, buttocks and shoulder blades, feel as if they were under a broiler. Pressed for a rational explanation of why she was lying face down in the Pacific, eyes open, gazing at a starfish, she could not have answered. But it was having an effect. Her heart, which had been thumping out of control, dropped to something much closer to a normal rate, and a surprising amount of time passed before she felt obliged to plant her hands and knees in the sand, push herself up on all fours, and suck in a breath of air. She got her legs under her and squatted, then pivoted so that her back was to the sea. Her legs and buttocks were still submerged, cooling off from the run. Bellad Tomov was standing a few meters away, surf washing around his ankles, breathing heavily, looking as though a dip in the icy Pacific might do him some good. But this was not his intent. He had been ready to pull Cath3 out if she had gone too long without breathing. They looked at each other, Cath3's gaze saying, "I would do you right here, right now," and his saying, "I know," and hers saying, "I know that you know." "Did you hear anything?" he asked. That was unexpected. "Just now," he explained, "when your head was under."
"You mean in the water?"
"Yes."
"Like what?"
"You haven't been listening, have you?"
Are you kidding? I've been listening so hard it's driving me out of my mind.
To the conversation, I mean.
No, everyone talks too loud.
He considered it. Then he turned a little to one side and stretched out one arm, drawing her attention to a rocky headland that interrupted the beach a few hundred meters away.
There, he said.
The thermal spike in her body had finally subsided, so she pulled her clothes back on, and they walked along the beach toward the headland, an abrupt, almost artificial-looking rampart of shattered rock held together by the roots of trees and scrub. It divided the beach like the blade of a shovel. She did not even know why they had been going to the sea. Was someone going to pick them up there? Was there even a plan? Or had they simply run away until they could run no farther?
The diggers believe, Bellad said, in the existence of people who live beneath the sea, the pingers. Supposedly there have been contacts at specific places along the coast of Beringia. He nodded in the direction they were going.
As in face-to-face contacts?
Bellad shrugged, a movement that, given the size of his shoulders, could almost be picked up on a seismograph. I fancied you might have heard something while your head was under the water, he said. They use a tech called sonar. Her disordered brain was a little wild putting this all together. She knew a little about sonar. Survey used it to map the bottoms of lakes and to count fish.
No coincidence that we are traveling with someone of that name?
Bellad nodded. She has been telling us about them, but much of it sounds more legend than fact.
Where do they live? Submarines?
He shrugged again. No one seems to know. Apparently they are good at holding their breath. The headland could not be skirted without a boat. They ended up cutting back inland so that they could get past it. This required gaining a couple of hundred meters in altitude and bushwhacking through vegetation that had grown thick on the south-facing slope. When they reached a place from which they could look down toward the sea, it became obvious that they were on the edge of an impact crater a kilometer or so in diameter. The headland that had blocked their passage down the beach was part of its rim. This curved out into the Pacific, forming one side of a bay. A mirror image of it, as they could now see, formed the opposite side. The bolide that had formed the crater had struck very close to the shore. The central impact peak was a sharp rocky islet, just a stone's toss from the beach, precisely centered between the twin headlands. It was easy enough for the eye to fill in the missing shape of the rim. Out in the water between the headlands, it must be slung in a submerged arc. And indeed it was possible to see waves breaking as they tripped over it. On the landward side, the rim blended into the natural slope. The impact had hollowed out a bowl whose steepness now forced Bellad and Cath 3 to make an awkward, skidding descent into the cove below. The beach there was more rocky than sandy, and many of the rocks had the translucency of wave-worn beach glass. They could hear the remainder of the party on the slope high above, catching up with them. The middle of the beach, just opposite the sharp little island, seemed like the natural place to make camp. A little heap of glassy stones had been made there, just big enough to make it clear that this was no natural deposit, but an intentional act. Their signal, Bellad explained. We should build a fire now.
He began ranging along the beach, picking up driftwood. Cath 3, drawn somehow by the cairn, squatted there to wait for the others. She could hear Sonar Taxlaw chattering as she negotiated the slope above, running circles around the others, whose footfalls and breathing were audible.
Their history is divided into three deluges. The first deluge was of rock and fire. It chased them into the deepest trenches of the sea, where it never fully dried out, even after the rest of the oceans had boiled off. They bred a race capable of living in confined spaces. The second deluge was of ice and water. The cloudy century,
Einstein said.
Yes, when you dropped comets on them for hundreds of years. They noticed that the seas were expanding, growing away from the trenches where they had been holed up, expanding their range. They transformed themselves into a race that could swim in the sea.
When you say they transformed themselves, asked Arjun, do you mean genetic engineering or...
Selective breeding,
Sonar insisted.
If wolves could become poodles in a few thousand years, think what humans could turn into if there was a need. They began to explore the seafloor. They found a lot of industrial junk that had been washed into the oceans during the hard rain and sunk to the bottom. There is nothing of metallurgy that is a mystery to them.
Which is why you trade with them? Ty ventured. Because you are short on metal?
And they are short on things we have, Sonar affirmed. You said there were three deluges, Einstein reminded her. The third deluge? Is now, said the psych. A deluge of life, beginning with microorganisms and culminating with you.
Meaning the spacers, Ty guessed.
Yes. And the only spacers they know about are the ones who dropped a lot of rocks into the Torres Strait and built the thing at Macassar.
How is all of this being imparted to you? Asked Arjun.
Imparted?
Have you, Sonar, actually had face-to-face conversations with pingers?
Me personally?
She asked, sounding amazed and horrified by the very idea.
Oh, no. Just looked down on them from up here.
So you lurk up above while more senior members of your clan go down to the beach and talk to the pingers.
Talking is difficult. Communication is mostly through the written word. They didn't have paper until we gave them some of ours. We use slates and chalk.
Kathry's eye went to a detail she had noticed a minute ago. An unnatural-looking deposit of flat black rocks, half buried in wave-driven sand. As the remainder of the party made their final descent to the water's edge, she used a piece of driftwood to scrape sand and gravel away from these until she could worry one loose. Though it was rough around the edges, it had clearly been shaped by humans. A slab of black rock, about as thick as her finger, big enough to hold in the crook of an arm, smooth enough to write on. Scattered in the muck around it, she'd seen lumps of calcium carbonate. Chalk. Traces of it were still visible on the slates. Not writing, but a fragment of a diagram, a map, perhaps, and a few numbers. Projecting from one side of the islet, just below the top of it, was a snarl of driftwood, the stump of a tree that a storm had torn from the edge of a cliff somewhere along the coast and later hurled up here. As soon as he arrived, Ty dropped his pack, emptied his pockets, and picked up the boxy equipment case that Roscoe's Yor had delivered in his glider. Holding this up above his head to keep it dry, he waded out to the islet, cursing at the intensity of the cold. At its deepest, the water came up to his waist, with occasional waves clipping him under the chin. He tossed the case up onto the flank of the islet, and then clambered up after it. After gazing curiously at the stump for some moments, he squatted down, gripped it by a couple of protruding roots, and overturned it, causing it to tumble into the surf. He then edged back out of the other's sightline to reveal what had been hidden beneath it, a vertical section of stout steel pipe, about a hand's breadth in diameter, rising to the height of a person's knee, topped with a flat disc of battered steel the size of a dinner plate. The pipe wasn't rooted to the boulder itself. It was part of a longer object that extended out into the sea. The part above the waterline was lashed to spikes that had been driven into crevices in the rock, in a style that they had already learned to recognize as typical digger improvisation. Ty's attention strayed to something he had noticed at his feet. He bent down and heaved it up so that all on the beach could see it. A sledgehammer, improvised from a length of pipe and a chunk of steel. Then he looked at the psych. Looking back at Ty, she held her hands out, palms toward the gray sky, as if to say, "See, just like I said." Ty turned away from them, gazing down into the sea before the boulder. After a few moments, he turned back around.
"How far does it extend?" he shouted.
"The pipe? A few score yards," answered the psych. "The crater is as a horn, channeling the sound out into the deep."
She had scarcely finished the sentence before Ty hauled off with the sledgehammer and brought it down with all his might on the steel plate. The result was a blindingly loud metallic ping, drowned out, as it faded, by a scream from Kathree, who sank to her knees in the sand with her hands clamped over her head.
"Better get her out of here," Ty said.
She could hear him through her hands. She felt Belled reaching around her from behind, crooking her in one arm below her breasts, heaving her to her feet. Which was welcome on one level. But she was tired of being the one who had to be carried, and so she unwound herself from him, turned her back on the sea, and marched up toward the belt of scrub that marked the limit of the beach. Ty gave her a respectable head start, before shouting,
"Plug your ears!"
She did so, and a moment later felt another ping go through her like an icicle jammed into the base of her skull. A moment later came another, and another, not in a steady rhythm, but sporadic. And by the time she had climbed up to a place where she could look down over the cove, fingers in her ears, and not suffer pain from each stroke of the hammer, she had made sense of what Ty was doing.